So I just want to say thank you guys for inviting me. And this has been a couple year challenge for me to kind of rework a lot of my thinking when it comes to health and medicine. So just briefly, I just kind of want to give a background, kind of how I got where I'm at. And I think that'll give some context as to the topics today. You don't have to read all this, but basically I'm from a small town in Texas. I graduated from there, went to Texas A&M University, got a finance degree, had no idea what I was doing. Went and worked for a year in Houston, Texas for sales tax consulting. Hated every minute of it. And sat in the cubicle and did the office space thing. And finally decided I wanted to go into medicine. So I had to start over, do prerequisites. That took a while in Dallas. So I started medical school when I was 27. But prior to medical school, so basically during that pre-med period, is kind of when I really got into theology. I had a lot of time. A lot of the classes I'd already had, so I was just having to retake them, so I didn't really have to go to class a lot. So I sat home in a little 373 square foot efficiency apartment in Dallas and just read the Bible and came across preterism. Just started devouring it, printed out. I had John Stuart Russell's Parousia printed like on paper and strewn all over the couch. I mean, it was crazy. And I emailed David in like 2005 and had questions, and he was gracious with his response. And I just started, soaking up everything I could from Berean. And so had a pretty good grasp of preterism going into medical school. And I was kind of always I don't want to say a free thinker, but a question asker. I was the little kid in Sunday school asking about time and eternity, and the preacher, the Sunday school teacher's just like, I don't know what you're talking about. I vividly remember those kind of questions growing up. So I always kind of asked why and asked how you know and all that. So it kind of was already there. One other thing, before I went to medical school, I got into more presuppositional apologetics. I started reading Gordon Clark from the Trinity Foundation, John Robbins, started reading on philosophy of science. So I had a pretty good grasp. I feel like going into medical school, a lot of the, I don't want to say nonsense, but a lot of the nonsense that is pushed in academia. And so I was able to spot that once I got to medical school. So it helped kind of already having that background. So I also, Sovereign Grace, so yeah, at the same time I became a preterist. I mean, I was already a, I don't want to say Calvinist, but whatever. That was pretty easy for me. I mean, I had never read the Bible on my own until I was like 23, 24. As I just started reading, and I saw this stuff pretty easily right away. And I was just like, am I going crazy? I've never seen this in my life, So that's how I kind of branched out and found all the online communities. But that's kind of the background. It's to kind of where I got where I am. And then, I'll just keep going real quick before I keep talking. This is me and my wife. That was our first day out of residency when we started our first jobs. That's coming up on 6 years ago. So we are both urologists. We now live in Paris, Texas. We started in Shreveport, Louisiana for 2 years as urologists in a private practice group. It was a massive group, 22 urologists. Lots of issues with it, lots of things that we didn't agree with. There was lots of financial issues. So when it came time to decide to buy into the partnership, we got out. And the Lord blessed us with a job in Paris, Texas, which is 45 minutes from my hometown right now. So it's been nice. And so we're urologists, and I don't have to go into what a urologist does, but we're plumbers essentially. There's other kinds of plumbers too, but yeah, we're plumbers. People always go, why urology? They're just blown away, and I'm just like, it's fun. I don't know. It is. Yeah. My wife will tell you. I mean, yeah, it's video game stuff, and you're doing scopes, but so yeah, I'm gonna scare people. That's our dog Maggie. We don't have any kids. We've been married about 6 years. We got married right before we started work in Shreveport. So, and we met in residency. I actually met her when I was in medical school. I was a fourth year, and I messaged her on Facebook because I saw she matched at the residency program I wanted to go to. She was a year ahead of me. And I Facebook stalked her and asked her questions. But we just remained friends up until I was probably my third year residency. And then she messaged me one night on a Friday night and said, "You want to come over for some fried deer steak?" And pulled. So she got me. Anyway, so kind of, again, more context as to why I'm talking about what I'm talking about. I could talk about this stuff all day. Even in medical school, I say going in with the foundation that I had philosophically about philosophy of science and then, you know, being a Christian, you immediately start seeing some red flags in how overall a lot of the things that are taught in medicine. You know, if you take what's called an ethics class in medical school, has nothing really to do with ethics, at least from the Bible, at all. It's actually, and it's just like everything else we see, it's an inversion of what ethics and morality really is. And so that kind of stuff, you know, you just get through it. It's cringy, but you just do it. I didn't think a lot about what was done because you're so busy just sucking in the information and memorizing everything. It's all it is the first couple years at least. And then once you get into like third and fourth year, you start actually seeing patients and putting your hands on people. And, you know, I didn't think too much of it again at the time, but it's because it's so much, you just have to get through it. And residency, I think, opened my eyes a little more to how things are done in medicine. But we were surgical. So there's a big dichotomy between like surgery and proceduralists and then the medical side of things. And so when it comes to like true health, chronic health issues, you know, we're not exposed to it as much, I guess, being surgeons. Surgery is more like, you know, it's caveman stuff. I mean, caveman. See problem, fix problem. Bye. You know what I mean? It really, it's not that hard as far as, you know, you usually know what the issue is. But I'd been into health for my whole life. Leah's, I mean, we work out. But until the last couple of years, I never really, I'd say the last 3 or 4 years, put as big an emphasis on it as I do now. And so my position now, and I just want to preface this, my point today is not to bash doctors necessarily. Doctors are good. Most of them are all good people. Same with nurse practitioners and nurses and all these people in the system. They're not malicious for the most part. Like, we all think we're doing the right thing. The problem is, in my opinion, the overall philosophy of Western medicine. Not in every aspect. Again, I think especially when it comes to certain surgeries and acute care, trauma, I think it's top-notch. My focus, the context is on health and chronic health, how that's treated versus kind of what I think should probably be done. And again, a lot of this is opinion. A lot of this I think would take a lifetime to figure out. I've just started looking into it really in the last couple of years, and there's just a whole different world out there that, you know, a lot of people don't know about when it comes to more holistic styles of life and beliefs about disease. But that's kind of, I just want to make sure people realize I'm not bashing doctors. It's more the belief system. And we all get sucked into belief systems without realizing why. And we just kind of go with the motions a lot of times. And, you know, Christians, we do this. And I would think, you know, as preterists, we know you have to look deeper. You have to go to the foundations. And we have to do that with everything in our life. And that's kind of what I've tried to start applying those principles to everything. And so my real focus was, can we find a biblical, being a presuppositionalist, so can we find a biblical philosophy of health? And at this point, by the end, I still don't know. It's been harder than I thought to find it. It's teased out in the Bible. So I'm asking for help for you guys down the road, because I think this is needed more than anything. When it comes to this topic, because I've found a couple books. The best one I found so far is a Reformed pastor named Jason Garwood. It's called Health for All of Life. It's really good. I still think he misses it a little bit. I think he takes some verses that are futurism type stuff out of context about healing of the nations, which is, you know, to be expected. So, but it's at least people are starting to look into it, because it seems to be not a taboo topic, but a topic just not addressed that much in Christian circles, especially with Christian physicians and things like that. So that being said, I threw up a Voltaire quote: "Doctors are men who prescribe medicines of which they know little to cure diseases of which they know less in human beings of whom they know nothing." So, and I hate to say it, that's actually kind of true in a lot of ways. And then Robert Mendelsohn was a pediatrician, and he wrote Confessions of a Medical Heretic, which I would recommend if anybody ever wants to read that. I gave it to my dad, but it was too many big words, and he just gave it back. But I'm not going to read all these quotes that I posted, but he's another good one that had a lot to say about the medical system after he'd been in it for a long time. So this was a quote from Malcolm Kendrick. Malcolm Kendrick is a Scottish general physician, and he's called out sort of the cholesterol con for the last several years. The cholesterol is demonized, and it shouldn't be. I always tell people God did not design us so that our own hormones and chemicals are killing us on the inside. Like, that's not quite how it works. And he's done some great work on this stuff. He's got a 65-part blog on what causes cardiovascular disease with papers. I mean, just you could spend days reading it. But he says nothing has changed so much in the healthcare system over the past 25 years as the public's perception of its own health. The change amounts to a loss of confidence in the human form. The general belief these days seems to be that the body is fundamentally flawed, subject to disintegration at any moment, always on the verge of mortal disease, always in need of continual monitoring and support by healthcare professionals. This is a new phenomenon in our society. I don't know if I fully agree with that. I think a lot of this stuff has probably been going on for longer than what he says. But in general, it's sort of this, the model we see now that the state and the medical industrial complex, if you will, is always looking out for you to help you with more and more drugs mainly. And there's rarely anything about health. So again, I think I've already talked about this, about why I'm giving this talk, but I didn't want to put up a lot of statistics. I'm not a statistics guy. They get boring. But you know, kind of as David said, that's kind of what was my impetus for doing this, is think of all the prayer requests, you know, every Sunday. Almost all of them have to do with health, somebody's health. That's a big deal. And so if we don't have an idea of what health even means, how do we even talk about it? But we see this, you know, every day. I mean, as physicians, obesity rates are through the roof. Cancer's still going up. They don't know, they claim to know what cancer is. If you start looking into that rabbit trail, it's kind of scary. All the research is done in petri dishes, all right? They don't even really look at cancer, at true tumors that much anymore. So there's this dichotomy now between the pathologist and then all the other researchers doing their petri dish stuff, because they can crank out the papers left and right. But the problem is they're not really looking for root causes in a lot of this. So cancer's going up. Diabetes is, I'd say, the number one issue we see. Insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome, it is rampant. And I think people take it for granted. My granddad took it for granted. My patients take it for granted. They're like, oh yeah, I got type 2 diabetes, but I take my metformin and I'm good. And they don't quite understand how big of a deal it is. And that a lot of it mostly is preventable. But the effects that, you know, type 2 diabetes and type 1, but type 2 more prevalent, the effects those have on the body are just unbelievable as far as wrecking your health in every tissue. And we see this all the time. And I talk to patients about it every time they come in. People think, you know, I'm a weird urologist, because they come in for one thing, and we end up talking about their diet, and we talk about their hormone status, and we talk about what they're working out, what they're doing, because to me, that's what health is truly about. It's like the whole picture, and I think we should all be talking to people about that, especially as we're healthcare workers, right? We should be talking about health. But yeah, prayers for health are ubiquitous. But how are we supposed to view health? You know, as Christians, we claim our truth comes from Scripture. And so we kind of need to have a paradigm to be able to even interpret anything being done in any area of life, not just in health. And so that was what I sought out to do, was to see if we could find that. You know, the problem always goes back to Genesis 3, and it's basically humanism, right? Like, that's the problem with all these systems. And that's where, if your foundations are wrong from the start, you're going to go off the rails with how you interpret life. And I don't, you know, I paid lip service to this kind of stuff as a young Christian. And then I think, again, the last 2 years especially, my eyes have been opened much more to the systems that are in place, the deeper philosophies involved. And it always is some type of humanism, always. That man knows better, that we can determine norms just by studying things, and you can't do that, right? You can't get an ought from an is. You can't just do statistics and do all this stuff and then determine what ought to be. And so these kind of things penetrate so many layers and so many areas and spheres of life. But expert worship is another big one. And as doctors, you see this. People put doctors especially up on pedestals, or anybody in a white coat. This kind of stuff has to stop, especially from Christians, in my opinion. Because, you know, David is very, I love how he's always talking about, don't believe me, you know, look it up for yourself, always. It's the same thing with anything else in life. It doesn't mean that you're going to be a subject matter expert on everything, because it would take multiple lifetimes to do that. But you can dig into this stuff, especially if you're passionate about it, because you have to, you know, people always say trust the experts, right? And it's like, well, which ones? Because there are people with the same exact qualifications, so they're all experts, but they disagree. So how do you decide? You have to have a standard by which to judge an expert, right? So the whole, it's a self-defeating argument to say trust the experts, because the experts change their minds. So then they were wrong, so how'd you know what I'm saying? It's like people who say that what is right is what is legal. Well, the laws change, so then what happened? Did morality change? It's the same issue. So always look for those kind of self-defeating arguments from people when they say just trust the experts or trust the consensus. It's not the way it should be. But this is a major problem, and I'll probably touch on that in the second lecture today. I wanted to show this clip. I'm not sure how to get this to play. Is there a way to, do I just click next? This is Francis Schaeffer. It's just a little clip about humanism, and I thought it was, I don't know why it's waving. Oh, that's that moving. It's the screen moving.
Have to understand.
Oh, you don't have audio? Well, I didn't know that. Oh, man. Okay. Well, that goes a lot of my slides then. What's that? Where's the speaker? It's okay. It's not a big deal. He's basically talking about humanism and how basically all of these things come from humanism as far as they're arbitrary, right? Where and his focus was a lot on law and man's standards versus God's. But it's the same thing with all these other areas, right? We need a standard to judge these things. We need a philosophy of health. We need a philosophy of art, right? Of aesthetics from a Christian standpoint. How do you look at art and know whether it's right or wrong, whether it's honoring God or not? Like, and those things are hard from Scripture. They don't really tease that out. It's almost like you just know sometimes. And I hate that, though. That bothers me when it's like, you know it when you see it, you know? And I wonder, though, I'm starting to wonder if health is kind of like that. And so I do go through some definitions of health real quick, because definitions matter. If we're not defining our terms, then we're going to talk and past each other. So when we talk about health, if you look into the etymology, it's wholeness. Actually, holy is also in there as well. The WHO definition, which actually is not terrible, health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. Merriam-Webster, the condition of being sound in body, mind, or spirit, or freedom from physical disease or pain. Healthfulness, a state of being well, a state in which the parts of a living body are sound and rarely perform their functions. Okay, well then you got to go, what does sound mean, right? What's a sound? And so you could, I drive myself crazy with this kind of stuff, because every word leads to another word, and you go, well, what does that mean? What does that mean? Who defined that, right? So I don't have an answer from the Scriptures as far as a definition of health. Even trying to deduce it is hard, because it already assumes we kind of know what it is. And I give some verses in here to talk about that. But basically, the point is how we approach health depends on how we define health, okay, just like anything else. There's a lot of scriptures in here. I'm not going to read every one, but basically they already talk about people being sick, people being ill, healing to the flesh, people needing a physician. So it already presupposes there's a such thing as disease, right, and ill health, but it never really defines what health is. And so I found that interesting. And so there are several of these like this. A lot of the time, though, you can't divorce it from the spiritual, right? Like in Scripture, at least, the spiritual health and physical health go hand in hand. But I think the context I'm trying to focus on today is physical health. Because if, let's say, we're doing what we're supposed to be doing, we're reading Scripture, we're glorifying God, we're trying to have a sound mind with all these things, there is still things in the physical that I think we can do to prevent being chronically ill. There were a few other things that, you know, people bring up, like the so-so and salvation can also mean healing in certain cases, which I meant to run this by David. but I'm not a Greek. I don't know anything about the Greek. But, you know, the James 5 there, apparently there's some people say that sick there could also be translated as weak, so it doesn't necessarily talking about healing the sick. These are the two that are taken out of context a lot by the futurists about the healing of the nations, right? And I don't necessarily think that is talking about physical health. And I think most of us probably would agree with that. Again, Scripture refers to people being ill, but it's hard to find a definition of health. And it also just kind of assumes we know what ill is when we see it. We see somebody with a deformed hand. We see somebody not able to walk, somebody crippled. So it already presupposes there's an ought, that's not how it ought to be. So it's kind of interesting. I have these questions in my mind, you know, can you be physically fit, picture health, and still be unhealthy? Well, spiritually, yeah, you could. And vice versa. Could you be somebody who's lots of chronic diseases, but loves the Lord, has joy, communion with other people? Could you consider that person healthy? And I mean, I think a lot of people might say, I'm healthy. I'm blessed, at least. Maybe not healthy. Maybe health is the wrong word. And again, that's why the words matter. And so I'm trying to really focus on health here and physical health, but I think you can't divorce it from the context of spiritual. What does it mean to be of sound body, mind, or spirit? Who determines that? Right? We would say Scripture determines those kind of things. And this is just stuff I need to look into in the future. I really want to start diving into this topic because I feel like it's really lacking out there. So let's keep going, as there are a lot of slides. So we talk about health, we got to talk about disease, right? Because we need a definition of disease. Condition of the living animal or plant body or one of its parts that impairs normal functioning and is typically manifested by distinguishing signs and symptoms. I think that's not bad. The other one, a disordered or incorrectly functioning organ, part, structure, system of the body resulting from the effect of genetic, developmental errors, infection, poisons. So all these things that can cause basically an incorrectly functioning organ is how they're describing disease. I would say genes and germs, I have some thoughts on. I touch on that in the second talk. But overall, that's not terrible. I mean, there's so many things that can actually cause dysfunction in our organs, and exposures and nutritional deficiencies, how we live, lack of exercise, those are the big ones that I see. And I think the modern health system has been focused on just the germs and the genes thing and kind of disregards a lot of the rest. They at least just pay lip service to it. So I'll keep going. We talk about diseases, so I don't want to read this whole thing, but Florence Nightingale, she was pretty awesome. You start reading a lot of her things, but basically she's talking about, she did not believe there were specific necessarily diseases, but there were, I guess, disease conditions, because she would see people manifest different supposed specific diseases all as a spectrum depending on how either they were getting worse or they started improving. And you could see one thing turn into another and all these things. And if you start going back and reading a lot of these old papers in the 1900s, early 1900s, it's pretty fascinating. There's a whole nother world out there of thought about health that's kind of been scrubbed, especially from the early 1900s. A lot of the more holistic side of things was very interesting. And I think a lot of people had good ideas, but those people were now relegated to quackery, right? And that all happened in the early 1900s after the Flexner Report, which I'll talk about here in a minute. But that's where kind of the term comes from, the quack. And you had a lot of natural, more holistic providers back then, in med schools as well. Are we viewing disease incorrectly, right? Like, our bodies are... Ooh, is that me? Our bodies are wonderfully made, right? And our bodies actually heal. We have an amazing capacity to heal. And so sometimes we view symptoms, and this is probably the biggest pet peeve I have with allopathic medicine. It's not just allopathic, actually. Holistic now and naturopath, they also see sometimes symptoms, they consider those as the disease, whereas symptoms are actually a sign of something else going on deeper. It's your body telling you something. It's like your check engine light going off. And symptoms aren't always bad. You have to decide why would a symptom be bad? Like a fever, right? Your fever is improving your circulation. It's improving your metabolism to try to clear something, and yet all we want to do is take something to stop it. So we want to do all these things to stop the way God designed our bodies to heal. And to me, that's a problem. And I think it drives disease deeper. Herbert Shelton was a part of it. It's called the natural hygiene movement. And overall, I've looked into some of their stuff. They're pretty good. I mean, they're a little strict on the diet. It was like pure vegan everything. And I'm not dogmatic about that kind of stuff. But, you know, they believe more that the body can heal. You need to just give it what it needs and get out of the way. But we erroneously interpret the efforts of the body to restore health as disease processes, blame them on bacteria and viruses, and treat them with deadly drugs. That's actually very true. It just is. And so we got to start looking at symptoms and disease in a different way. I put a definition of medicine up here. There's two different ways to think of medicine. One is a practice and one is a drug. Okay, that's just why I put that up there. But the science, I'll use that term loosely, science. It's more just the practice of diagnosis, treatment, or prevention of disease. I don't see a lot of prevention of disease in modern medicine. Like I said, I know people pay it lip service. But even then, like if you have a provider that's telling people, we got to get your cholesterol down to prevent you from having a heart attack, they haven't been looking into the right stuff. They just haven't. So they're going to tell you to take your statin to get your cholesterol down. Statins are horrific. I mean, they just are. And again, your cholesterol is not out to kill you. If I see somebody with a crazy low HDL and high LDL, I'm going to first start talking about their metabolic health. Do you have type 2 diabetes? What's your liver health like? That's it. I mean, let's look for the root, not for these. Basically, what happens in medicine, and I think I talk about this later, but, and this is not just in medicine, we take effects and confuse effects as causes, and they make drugs to kill the effect. And that just worsens the situation. And this happens everywhere in academia, in every area where people confuse effects with cause. It's one of the most common things I see. And so I'll talk more about drugs in a minute. This is just quick history. You know, there's been different schools of thought about medicine since the beginning. And a lot of this stuff, again, how do you know it's true? History, it's hard to know. You can get Gordon Clark's book on historiography if you want your mind blown sometime about that. But, you know, there were always magicians, healers, witches, all these people. Early on, Hippocrates and kind of his school, the common thought was that there was imbalance in what they called the four humors, right? I can't remember what they were, black bile, four different things. And if you corrected those imbalances, then and so if you think about that. So that's their paradigm. Now think about how that could turn into some really crazy treatments, right? Because they believe that as their foundation. So then you start interpreting the world based on that paradigm. And it's the same thing. So that's why paradigms matter. You have to get your foundation right or you're going to go off the rails. Same with eschatology, right? If you assume a dispensational system, then everything you start interpreting is going to look like black helicopters and blood moons and stupidity. And so, sorry. It's true. But it's very applicable, right? All these things, it works the same way. So you have to get your paradigm right. I think it's miasma or miasma theory was around for a long time, till like the early 1800s, which was, I think it probably had some merit. A lot of belief, a lot of correlations, at least with illness in certain places and what people would call foul air. I mean, even like things with earthquakes and volcanoes and climate activity and things going on, they would notice people getting sick. You know, think people that live closer to certain swamps with dead animals and things like that. A lot of that stuff has just been blown off now. And I think that's, I don't know what the reason is for that. Heroic medicine, that's kind of an interesting name. That was basically all the bloodletting. So they were basically taking the four humors idea and taking it to extremes. That's a picture of a bloodletting going on, which people still get, you know, phlebotomies now for various reasons. Some good, some bad. It's just pictures of some different things. Witch doctors on the top left, a shaman on the right. The bottom is Morrison's vegetable pills. They were sold to cure about 1,000 different things. So you got to watch out for all the charlatans. And I think people are tuned into that, you know, when they supplements and all these things. But what medical doctors, especially, they don't realize they're part of this as well. So they see all this stuff and go, yeah, that's quackery. But what we're doing is the right way. We're selling the right drugs. We're doing all the right things. And I don't agree with that. And so it's just interesting. So homeopathic, naturopathic, that was very popular in the 1800s and early 1900s. And then if you guys will ever have time to look into the Flexner Report and what that did to medical schools in the United States, it almost overnight, and this was Rockefeller and Carnegie, got their boy Flexner to go and write up a report on the state of medical education. And they pretty much went from, I can't remember the number of medical schools, but it was cut by like 75% almost overnight after the Flexner Report. And basically all of those bigwigs took interest in all the remaining medical schools to promote what is called Rockefeller medicine. But again, it sounds conspiracy theory stuff. It's not. This stuff is all documented. You can read it. If you go back and read these early papers, it's really amazing, because it's stuff that now people would say that's just kooky. It's all out there to find. You just have to put the time in to do it. And people called this stuff out left and right, right? It's no different than people calling Einstein out for relativity. And there's all kinds of people going, this is insane. None of this is real. And didn't matter. The more insane it was, they just go, yep, that's our new paradigm. We're going to go with that. And then all the people are left in the dust. The Ayurvedic, I don't know how to say it, is still around in India and China. It's very kind of herbal-based. But they still are all about suppressing symptoms with herbs instead of drugs. So, again, it's probably not near as toxic as what we do, but there's some issues there. There's a lot of mysticism with it. They balance what they call the three doshas. It sounds, again, like the four humors type thing. So there's all these different interesting philosophies. Yeah, we're not going to be able to hear that. That was G. Edward Griffin talking about what happened to the medical schools. If you guys know who G. Edward Griffin is, he wrote The Creature from Jekyll Island about the Federal Reserve. He's really good on cancer and talking about a lot of these things from history of what happened. And it's so interesting how much of this stuff happened in the early 1900s. And everything just changed with Federal Reserve, with Rockefeller and the Flexner Report, all these things, the big oil leading to basically using their waste products, turning those into pharmaceuticals. They did. I encourage everybody to, if you're interested, go start looking into some of this stuff. You could go down a lot of rabbit trails. Again, natural hygiene I talked about earlier is basically just sort of more of a holistic approach. They really hated the modern upcoming allopathic model at the time. And a lot of it were former MDs that kind of left and went more of a holistic route. There was no biblical foundation. I've read some of the people, some of their quotes, and they were very humanistic, which is the case with most things. So, again, that's why we're doing this, is I feel like we have to start, as Christians, developing a true Christian philosophy of health and disease and medicine. So they got caught up on food combinations and stuff. I mean, I'm in some Facebook groups with some of these people, and it's all, oh, it's all just vegan, or, oh, it's fruit only, fruitarians, right? You can only eat fruit. That's the only way to live. And it's like, it's not quite that black and white. But we can talk about that. So allopathic and osteopathic. Osteopathic was pretty like holistic at first. And now it's hard to distinguish osteopathic from allopathic. And again, I left out the surgery part and the acute trauma part because that's not the focus of the talk. I think that all those things, for the most part, are great. If you have a broken leg, if you're in a car wreck, if you've got a kidney stone, or you've got an esophageal stricture, or whatever you need, and you need a procedure, you can't wait that out sometimes. You just need it done, and that's fine. It's different than the current model of pills, 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 vaccine, vaccine, vaccine. And so that's kind of been my biggest issue with medicine in general. I don't know how it came to be. Again, Flexner Report, but there's some quotes in here. Carolyn Dean wrote a book. It was really good, I need to read it. I've just read bits and pieces free online. But she basically said allopathic doctors began amassing power as early as 1759. I think that was in Britain. So I think a lot of this stuff started in Britain and carried over, which is common, again, with a lot of things. Kind of like they brought corporatism and mercantilism over here when the U.S. was founded. It didn't just spring up here. But at that time, legislation was drafted to protect an unsuspecting public against quacks or snake oil salesmen. The irony is the snake oil salesman was actually more the Rockefeller guys with their oil-based products. So that's kind of interesting. But yeah, it's always about protecting you, right? When the big regulatory bodies come in and the statists and the people that are pure humanists with terrible, terrible philosophies, they always claim they want to protect you. Anytime you hear that, you should probably, it should alert you a little bit that that's not really what's going on, in my opinion. I don't trust these systems. John Tilden, I think, was one who left did his own thing. He said, 25 years in which I used drugs and 33 in which I have not used drugs should make my belief that drugs are unnecessary and in most cases injurious, worth something to those who care to know the truth. And Carolyn Dean, again, drugs are synonymous with modern medicine. That's not wrong in general. Almost all of us have gone to our general practitioner for some complaint and it's prescription right away and you're out the door. Leah and I, you know, in practice, I mean, the amount of people that come in on 20 plus pharmaceutical medications is unbelievable. I don't know how people are actually walking or driving. I don't. It's actually a testament to the resiliency of the body is what it is, that we can survive what we do. But at some point, those things, eventually there's a tipping point for different people depending on their health. They start having all kinds of issues. And I talk to people about getting off their medicines. And even if it's not a medicine I prescribe, we talk about it at least. I say, why don't you ask your cardiologist about that? Why don't you ask your GP about that medicine? Why are you on that? You know, why are you on you're 93 years old and you're on Eliquis, you're on a blood thinner? Why? You fall and hit your head, you're dead. I mean, it just, so many interesting things. It just bothers me. So this is, again, current model is humanistic, right? We're simply just a bag of chemicals in motion. And we're just an animal, right? Hence, you know, a lot of the Darwinist nonsense. And that's, so basically, you know, vivisection is still alive and well. They used to do horrible things to animals and we think that's all past and it's not. It's just a little more hidden now. But they do all these things to animals assuming we are just like animals. There's lots of books, there's lots of articles, things you can read on how what they do to animals does not apply in reality to the human physiology. We're different, and we're not just a bag of chemicals. And this is another thing, again, I've kind of probably talked more in the second lecture. When you start looking at how they study all these things they claim in us that go on, because there's all kinds of stuff that comes out, and we found this marker, and this does this, and this does this. They don't study any of that inside a person. Okay, they're doing all of this in outside of the body, ex vivo, doing little chemistry reactions, basically. And I think when the chemists took over with biology is when a lot of this stuff went off the rails. Biology is more of a holistic approach. You're studying a creature. You can't really tear the person down into these parts and claim that this is doing that and this is doing that. Everything's like a symphony in the body. But that's not how a materialist is going to see it. And materialism rules modern medicine. It really does, as far as philosophy. We'll keep going. So this is a quote just about vivisection, just talking about how it's basically a joke. Just because there are some common characteristics doesn't mean that what they do to animals applies to us. And you see that all the time with rat studies and guinea pig studies and things. This was a quote from Gordon Clark that I liked. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but this was actually from his historiography book, which I thought was interesting, but I'm not sure how he brought this up. In the case of organisms, mechanism has not only succeeded, but it is in principle impossible. It is impossible because an organism, unlike an internal combustion engine, is constructed so that not only does the whole depend on the parts, but the parts depend on the whole as well. A human body no doubt depends on hands, eyes, and kidneys, but if separated from the body as a whole, these cease to function, they decay, they're no longer organs. That is, as the body depends on them, so they in turn depend on the body. And that's how we're made, right? We are a whole creature. And we have specialties where we break everything down like into gastroenterology or urology and all these different little, we choose these systems, but you see the overlap once you've done medicine long enough. You start seeing how it's all connected. And a lot of people that have tissue issues here will have these issues in other areas of the body. It's not always just one organ system. But again, you know, just how we compartmentalize things. This, everybody's new hero, right? This is a guy literally talking about how we are just a brain in a vat and wants to connect people with his Neuralink stuff. And he's the new libertarian hero just because he's talking smack about Bill Gates. It's just, Christians have to be more discerning about this. A lot of my Christian libertarian friends love Elon Musk. I don't get it. Anytime the mainstream is propping somebody up, you should probably look into what he was talking about. because this is what, you know, the technocratic future, and people, I think Christians especially kind of shy away from talking about this stuff. They think it makes them sound like conspiracy theorists. It's all out there. It's all real. It's all in your face. They throw it in your face, and we just kind of go, yeah, it's not, nah, they're just, that's not the big a deal. It is a big deal. And I'm not saying this is going to happen, because I think their egos are bigger than they realize. But, you know, it's the same with the World Economic Forum, right? Noah Harari, whatever their spokesman is, who's talking about essentially man merging with AI, and that's the new goal, right? It's just humanism just recycled over and over again. It's Tower of Babel. It always is. It's man, we can reach God. We can become our own gods. And that does apply in a way to a lot of the philosophy of medicine as well, because all these things they're tied together when you're dealing with humanism. And so that's, to me, that's interesting. Symptoms are seen as bad, right? We talked about that. And that's what, you really start seeing that. And I saw that early on. I see it more now. The more and more I see patients and see what doctors write prescriptions for, is they're literally, all we do is putting a piece of tape over our check engine light and going, okay, I fixed it. I mean, it is. It's unreal. Take an ibuprofen for a fever or whatever. Anti-inflammatories galore, right? Like, I learned this in med school. I'm going, wait a minute. Inflammation is healing. Why do we want to stop healing? Well, because it hurts, right? It sucks. I get it. I mean, and there's probably a place, if you're in such acute pain that your blood pressure's through the roof and you're about to stroke out, okay, fine, take a pain pill, right? I get it. But chronic anti-inflammatories, you're not healing anything at all. You're actually making things worse, because inflammation is not the devil. Inflammation is a response to something else. And so that always drove me crazy. And it's the same with heart disease. You know, they talk about, well, you got this inflammation in the lining of your blood vessel. Well, the inflammation's there because your lining of your blood vessel were damaged from something, right? You have endothelial damage, then everything comes in to seal the gap. And that's where you get the plaque. And then they blame the plaque on everything. They found some cholesterol in a plaque one time and go, oh, cholesterol must be the cause of this. It's really poor thinking. And not once will you find actual scientific evidence that our own lipids are causing those plaques in our body. You won't find it. But it's easier just to craft a story and sell a drug. I mean, it really is. So that's my, again, big elephant in the room, is why can't we get more to the cause of disease, the root cause, and focus on that instead of masking symptoms? Because taking all these drugs to mask our symptoms can create 10 new problems. And these drugs are not always safe. So this is, again, my opinion. I think we are poisoning ourselves in the name of health, and I think that's a big part of medicine. It's just, and again, these doctors aren't bad people. They think they're doing the right thing. I'm not knocking that, but we all know where intentions lead, right? Good intentions. If they're wrong, they're wrong. If they're based on a false premise. David Eddy of Duke University, only about 15% of medical interventions are supported by solid scientific evidence. Science is, he uses that word wrong there. We'll talk about that later today, but it's kind of a pet peeve of mine. But overall, he's right. Drugs, I wanted to talk about, because I thought this was interesting. Here's the definition of a drug. Any substance that affects the structure or functioning of a living organism. What's the definition of a poison? Any substance that irritates, damages, or impairs the activity of the body's tissues. I mean, you call poisons drugs and it does soften the blow, right? And I'm not saying every single drug is in this category. That's not what I'm saying. I'm talking in generalities here. But if you know, I'm friends with a guy, he just got out of the, he's a molecular biologist, and he worked in pharma for 15 years. And we talk a lot on Telegram. And he's done some podcasts recently just talking about how most of these drugs, they have no idea how they work in the body. They don't know the actual mechanism. And I knew that in med school, when they start teaching you how they discover certain drugs and why they name them the way they do, it's a joke. A lot of times it's just like, oh yeah, we did this and we paralyzed this in the body, therefore we're just gonna claim it does this to a receptor that we've never seen, and yeah, that'll work for that. Not realizing it's doing all these other things in the body as well. And that's what drives me nuts, is they call these things side effects. There's no side effects, they're just all effects. It's a side effect if it's not the effect you want. Okay, so that's the issue there. But they all have effects. Some are more selective than others as far as causing certain effects. But a lot of these things impair something natural, something the way we were designed to do. These drugs go in there and inhibit something. And over time, can that cause issues? Yes, in my opinion. Maybe not every single drug. There's plenty. Again, we're resilient creatures, so we can probably withstand a lot of this stuff. It doesn't necessarily mean it's the right thing to do. So let's go over here. Big Pharma. Yeah, Big Pharma is not a myth. I threw this in here just because some people liked it. I don't like all this kind of stuff, this whole guilt by association or what are their motives? Like, whatever. It doesn't matter what their motives are. What matters is what's going on, what's the philosophy. But there are a lot of conflicts of interest with FDA and their budget and all this stuff. And some people focus on that, just like they've done over the last couple years with Fauci and all that. Drug development is really the name of the game, though. Motive actions are really not known. They're tested. Basically, a lot of these drugs are not tested in even animals anymore. They make up these so-called molecules in petri dishes and then just throw the drugs at them in a petri dish and see what happens. And they just, that's it. Oh yeah, that looks safe. And then they'll do some, you know, clinical trials eventually, but we all know how that can go. And the animal models they use, you guys should see some of the ways they treat these animals and what they do. They're these just crazy, let's say mutated, I hate that word even, but they're not normal animals and they're not humans. And yet they do all this stuff and they know they're gonna get the effect they want because they've damaged the creature in a way that they're gonna get that effect. That's why everybody, like the term guinea pig came from, right? Like why it's so often to say I'm a guinea pig. Guinea pigs literally die at, you can look at them wrong and scare, I mean, it's unreal. And I never knew that until I started reading a lot of other papers and seeing why they started using guinea pigs and going, man, these guinea pigs are weak, you know? Like, it's amazing. But it works really well when you're trying to get an effect that you just wanna see, so. But the desirable effects are chosen and the unwanted effects are labeled as side effects, which I already talked about. So these are common and we all know this, I think. If you've been to, we have friends, a lot of people are probably already on these, but these are the most common medicines, drugs that are prescribed. These all have, I didn't want to go through side effects or effects of every one of these, but it just would take too long, but they all can have major issues. And so, I mean, I see it from a urology standpoint, just blood pressure medicine alone. We got a guy who's been diagnosed recently with hypertension. He's thrown on two new blood pressure medicines. And now he can't get an erection. I mean, and they want us to fix it. And I go, you didn't talk to your primary care doctor about, you know, first of all, are you exercising? Are you overweight? What's your blood pressure? Like, all these things you have to get to the root of. But instead of that, the GP goes, okay, here's some hydrochlorothiazide and lisinopril. Go away. And then they're having all kinds of issues from that, not just ED, okay? That's just one example. Chronic antibiotic prescribing is insane, just insane. Antibiotics are not specific for bacteria. They damage the body. They are very harmful, more harmful than I think we realize. But again, we just take it for granted because it's just the way things are done. You know, when I was little, you got a sore throat, oh, call our local ENT. He's a friend at the church. He's going to give you a Z-Pak, right? Never needed it. Would have gone away. You know, fast for a few days, rest, drink fluids, it goes away. But we just take all these things, and antibiotics can make you feel better, not only because they're killing bacteria, but they actually suppress the immune response, inflammatory response. They affect the way white blood cells work. They make you feel better. It's just like giving somebody a dose of prednisone, of a corticosteroid. You're literally turning off their ability to heal something. So you feel great while the healing stops. And so those, again, could go all day about this stuff. So what makes us ill? You know, this is hard to talk about in, when you know you have a sovereign God that controls everything, right? How do you start teasing out cause and effect in the world when you know that God controls everything, every outcome for his own reasons? And I don't know, honestly. I don't have a good answer. It's, you know, we can always talk about primary versus secondary causes and all these things. It is what it is, but I think there are principles of healthy living that we, you know, just like there's principles of living other ways that just, even though God can take us in a heartbeat, we're still probably gonna wear our seatbelt in the car. I mean, I kind of think about it like that, but these kind of things keep me up at night. Yeah, like they did when I was a kid. I thought this quote from Spurgeon was good. I think his wife passed away. She was very ill. It would be a very sharp and trying experience to me to think that I have an affliction which God never sent me, that the bitter cup was never filled by his hand, that my trials were never measured out by him, nor sent to me by his arrangement of their weight and quantity. And I mean, that's a guy who believed in the sovereignty of God. And so we do have to take all this into account as Christians. You have to understand that we should be joyful in all these situations like David was talking about yesterday. no matter what our circumstances, glorify God, you know, even when it's painful. What makes us ill? Chemicals. Man, my wife bought a book recently. I can't remember the name of it, Leah. It was just going through all the chemicals in everyday products that we use. It is mind-blowing. And this is stuff that, again, I think we take for granted. We're like, it's probably not that big a deal. I mean, everybody does it, right? We all are exposed to this stuff. It's probably safe because somebody somewhere tested it and told us it was safe. It's not, especially when it's chronic exposure to thousands of chemicals every day, your whole life. And so these are everywhere. And, you know, there's lots of good books about this that you can read about, how much chemical waste is dumped and where. Again, I'm not going to belabor that. Petrochemicals are a major source. And again, I think this causes a lot of triggering for people because, like, especially like Christians are more on the conservative side, right? And so we're all like pro big oil, right? We love our oil. And we're missing the point of the bigger picture of, number one, what is this stuff doing? I mean, there's politics involved with all the oil stuff, obviously, that's insane. But what's the bigger picture? It's okay for a Christian to be concerned about our environment, okay? It is. Like, that's not a hippie lefty thing. I think people love to put people in these categories instead of us. We should be outside of all of those categories. For the most part, and go, is this the right way to treat the creation? And not only that, but are these byproducts, what are they doing with them? Are they harming the water supply? Are they destroying the food supply, ruining the soil, the air, the things we breathe? What are they using to make drugs with? Byproducts of chemicals, petroleum products especially. So again, you can still advocate for, you know, your favorite energy of choice and still call out things that I think are dangerous. We got to get out of that false dichotomy, I think. Fracking is an interesting one. I read a lot about that. Amazing what that does and the way they do it. And again, that's a big political thing. So they get people sucked in and to think they got to cheer for the fracking because that's a Republican thing or whatever. And it's like, it's not about that. We got to stop, again, my opinion, got to stop thinking politically and start thinking like Christians, because these things do have major effects on the water supply and on the soil. And on how we do a lot of things. Pesticides are ubiquitous still. Glyphosate is a major one now people talk about in Roundup, but they've been spraying this stuff for a long time. They used to spray DDT directly on people. Before that, it was lead arsenate, right? And they both of those can cause paralysis. Funny enough, can cause things that look exactly like polio. Shocker. And so, you know, this is a big one that we've tried to start avoiding. I went the other day to put out some, I was going to put out some pre-emergent in our yard, and I just finally just read the label, and I told Leah, I was like, I can't do it. I don't want our dog tracking through this stuff. I don't want this stuff seeping into the ground. I'm not going to do it. I'll deal with the weeds in another way. Because all this stuff eventually, I think, is going to cause issues. It already is. This was from The Big Unknowns of Pesticide Exposure. Synergistic effects between multiple pesticides and or other chemicals represent one of the greatest gaps in the EPA's ability to protect the public from the adverse health effects associated with pesticide use and exposure. Basically saying they can't really know what's going on with the synergism of all these things together. So what they do with any of these chemicals or pesticides is they'll study things in a vacuum, not literally a vacuum chamber, but alone, short-term exposure. They're not looking at everything that we would be exposed to over a lifetime. I mean, they're just not. And I don't know that you could do that. I mean, it'd be hard to do. So you do have to rely on a lot of statistics, but a lot of those things get buried or blamed on something else is what I see. So you have a lot of toxins out there and they'll go, oh, we got an outbreak of blah, blah, blah virus or something. When in fact, it was probably just some type of poisoning situation. And so this is a big one. It's near and dear to my heart, endocrine disrupting chemicals. So I deal with hormone replacement. I don't consider a hormone replacement the same as a drug because I feel it's no different than if you can't make that essential hormone anymore, you probably need to take it. We would never tell a type 1 diabetic you can't take insulin. Insulin's a hormone too. And there's issues around some of that and the way some of them are made, but I think we see the benefits and no harm the way we do it. And so to me, it's a big deal. I'm seeing 20-year-olds coming in with testosterone levels of 100, sperm counts zero. And this is becoming very common. and I don't think it's by accident. And sperm counts are going down across the world. Testosterone levels are falling all over the world. The normal values now are down into the upper 100s is still considered normal. It's insane. That's not even close to normal. Top of the range now is like 800. 20 years ago, it was over 1500 for normal. So you have to be careful when you look at these ranges on your lab work. People like to just, doctors especially love labs. They love data. And so if you're anywhere in the normal, you're good. Like, they don't even think about your complaint or what you're actually talking about. And so I deal with this all the time, Leah and I both. Some guy comes in with a testosterone of 200, and his doctor said, oh, you're normal, you're fine. He's not fine. But this, all these things, and there's a lot of people that are doing good research on EDCs, so it's something else you could look into. But lots of things, triclosan is in, you know, the hand washes that we'll use at the hospital. These top five are really the biggies, but antibiotics can also cause endocrine disruption. So chronic antibiotic use is going to be an issue. Heavy metal exposure, that's a biggie. Heavy metals are in a lot of things. The worst is when you're injected with heavy metals. And that really comes from one place, which is vaccines for the most part. And so when you're starting to find high levels of heavy metals in Alzheimer's and Parkinson's patients, kind of start gonna go, how did the heavy metals get there? Because when you ingest it, almost 100% is evacuated in the stool. When you inject it, almost all of it is absorbed. And so heavy metals are a big deal. Again, pesticides, these are all endocrine disruptors. There's like, 1,500 chemicals, maybe more now. When was my time? I'm going long, aren't I? Okay, I'm gonna wrap it up, sorry. Let's keep going. Poison air. These? Yeah, I know. People think that's kooky. Those are real. Yeah. I don't know what's in them, but they're real. They're not contrails. Especially not contrails when people are flying squiggly lines with them in circles. That's not any normal air traffic pattern. So I don't know what's in them. Maybe somebody will figure it out. EMFs, that's a big one. Y'all can read The Invisible Rainbow. It's a good book. Arthur Furstenberg talking about a lot of issues from that. I'm going to skip to the end. What do we need to do? This is my opinion. Holism, get back to more holistic living, not just with like how we approach health, but community. Get back to even maybe the more agrarian styles of living. Honestly, the earthly systems, these people are corralling us, especially into the cities. The smart city is going to be the newest thing. You could probably still do community stuff in a city, but we've got to get away from all these secular systems. The basic principles are not that hard. Eat right. And nutrition, and we could talk about that. Fruits, veggies, diets, meat. Some people do carnivore, some people do fruit. It doesn't matter. Stay away from all the processed crap. Stay away from things covered in pesticides. Try to get grass-fed beef, grass-fed, you know, things that are raised the right way, that aren't poison. Avoid toxins and drugs. Try not to be on a million prescription drugs. You won't need to be if you're doing all these things. Exercise is huge. I mean, even just a little bit is important. And then exercise the mind. Read the scriptures. So this is the Hobbit house, right? Like, that's my idea of beautiful living. Even the architecture is beautiful. It's flowing. It's not jagged lines, right? Like, Tolkien was onto some stuff. But there's a local garden in the house. There's people exercising. And then, I wish I could play that for y'all because that was a good one. But talking about getting people out of the cities. So anyway, that was G. Edward Griffin. Yeah, and that's us. So anyway, I'll wrap it up. So any questions? Yeah.
Okay. You said that the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island wrote a book about health. What was it?
No, he's done a lot of stuff on. I don't know the name of if he wrote a book, but he's talked a lot. You can find him on YouTube. G. Edward Griffin on cancer.
G. Edward Griffin.
Uh huh. And he wrote The Creature from Jekyll Island. But I had forgotten how into health he was until I just started doing this presentation. It had been a long time since I came across his name. I was in medical school when I started reading about the Federal Reserve. But yeah, he's got some interesting stuff.
Is he a preterist? You should expose him to preterism because you know what? He's amazing.
Yeah. Oh, he is. Yeah.
Yeah. He would research that out.
I bet he would.
Yeah.
Anybody else? So I'll find out for you and let you know because it was an excerpt from something, but I had seen it on an Instagram post. Somebody had put a different video to his voice, and it was just fantastic, and talking about how they want to get you back into the cities and do all these things. And I found what it was from and put it on there. It's really, he's got some good. Yeah, I think that was pretty recent. I can. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I could. Thank you.
Like Jordan said, he can make that presentation available. So if you want that, you can read every specific thing on there.
It's stuff that we all, I think, know deep down. It's just hard to put into practice. And we've really started doing it more in the last 6 months, really being conscious of where we buy our food, things we use at the house. I mean, we're getting rid of all the toxic cleaning stuff and finding other things to use. So I think every little bit may help. So one more. Did the rabbit study with the...
He's the one who said that saturated fat, meats, and cholesterol were causing heart disease.
Right.
It was paid off by the sugar industry to make that lie.
Yeah.
And cholesterol in your diet is necessary.
Yeah.
Saturated fat give you more energy and nutrients than any vegetable.
Yeah.
And the he was in charge of the making of the FDA food pyramid.
Yep. Yeah.
So
yeah. Yep.
Diabetic issues and heart disease for the last 30 years.
Well, I mean, I grew up, in the 80s, right, was the low-fat craze. And I had everything low-fat. I mean, I was a fat kid, too. I had boobs. Like, I mean, it was bad. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, too many calories is going to make you fat. But, yeah, the demonization of fat and cholesterol is it's a red herring, so... Yeah.
And giving it the drug, so they're not even testing it on humans. So it's this inanimate object. They have absolutely no idea what the side effects are going to be.
Yeah, they'll do a clinical trial in humans, but again, those are short term. They're usually smaller sample sizes, and they can tweak the statistics how they want. And so, but yes, they develop them based on things that have nothing to do with a human body. And this is the same in cancer research. It's the same in virus research. Yeah, it's a big deal. But it's easy to pump out papers and drugs when these cell lines are rapidly changing and you can constantly keep them alive and grow new ones all the time. And so it's a lot. They do, yeah. And they don't even know why it works. It's just like, oh, look, that's interesting. Let's try that. And so, yeah.
All right, good.
Thank you, guys.
Appreciate it.
Yeah.